Welcome. Thank you for coming to this podcast. I'm so excited to be joined today by Dr. Kate Ellingson. I'm especially excited because she's my own mentor, and so I just love that everyone gets a chance to chat with her because I think she's pretty amazing. Not that I'm sucking up on my podcast, but that's what's happening a little bit. Dr. Ellingson received her PhD in epidemiology and public health from Yale University in 2006, and then she joined the CDC Control and Prevention as an Epidemic Intelligence Service Officer, and she worked there for 7 years as an epidemiologist studying healthcare-associated infections and transmission of multidrug-resistant organisms in healthcare settings. That is quite the mouthful and very impressive. So just for those listeners that might not know, what was your job like as an EIS officer? I think that's really interesting.
Sure. Thank you. Thank you, Sana. Thank you for having me here. So after I completed my PhD, I wanted to do some applied work because I had been sitting in an ivory tower analyzing data and wanted to get out into the field. And so the Epidemic Intelligence Service, or EIS program, offered that opportunity. So I was placed in Atlanta, the mothership of CDC, in a division that did work on healthcare-associated infections, which has continued as a primary research interest to this day. And it was really an opportunity to go out and investigate outbreaks, learn how to work with clinical partners, state health departments, understand CDC as an organization and how it fit in, and really just a chance to gain all kinds of analytic skills, database management skills, communication skills, both with communicating with scientists, but communicating with the public. So it was just a remarkable experience. And I thought I would be at CDC for 2 years and ended up staying there for seven because it would just sort of sucks you in. And I think it's a wonderful place to work.
After the CDC, you moved to Oregon, correct? And worked as a senior epidemiologist at the Oregon State Health Department. What was that like?
So moving to a health department was really interesting because at CDC, you're often in your silo and doing really in-depth work on a particular topic, and you get a chance to work with people across divisions, but you sort of become an expert in one area. And working in a health department is fascinating because they're chronically understaffed, and so everybody gets to do a lot. So you're always working with others who have other kinds of expertise, and you're doing everything from foodborne outbreaks. I was placed in acute and communicable disease prevention, and so I was working up foodborne outbreaks, running a system for reporting healthcare-associated infections, working on vaccine-preventable diseases. I was also the arbovirus contact person, so when Zika hit, I was the person who was managing that response.
Wow.
So you really get a chance to do a lot. And the State Health Department is where the rubber meets the road. That's really where the state has the authority to do the investigations. Mm-hmm. And you learn very quickly at CDC that CDC has to be invited by the state. So it's, I really feel lucky to have been able to have both experiences. And now to be in academics and working with people who want to go work in those settings is really exciting to me.
Yeah, quite the journey to get here.
Yeah.
I know the topic for today isn't Zika, but how was being on that team like? I feel like that would just be a crazy experience to be able to deal with something that's in the national news every day.
It was really hectic. It was fascinating. It was difficult, rewarding. It was kind of all of the above. Definitely, Oregon, we didn't have the Aedes aegypti mosquito, which is the vector for Zika virus, but we did have many returning travelers who had it. Mm-hmm. And I think the most fascinating thing for me was sort of watching the evolution of our own knowledge about the disease and how that altered our response. So, for example, in the beginning, we had no idea about sexual transmission. And actually, in Oregon, we had the second documented sexual transmission because we knew that the person in our state had not traveled, and that was the only possible way for acquisition of the virus. And so all of a sudden that changes the public health response. And speaking to pregnant women who have potentially been exposed or who have exposed partners, all of a sudden in acute and communicable diseases, we were working with the birth defects people on a totally different floor who we never spoke to about what is microcephaly? What does that case definition look like? We were talking to people in STDs about how to educate the public.
That's like a crazy situation to be in, talking to all those different departments at once. And I'll just ask the question now, since we're talking about it, what would be your tips? Your tips for how to properly communicate when you are working with such different people from different backgrounds. How do you bring them together? And you mentioned speaking with pregnant women. How do you do that in a way that doesn't cause like severe panic in the public?
It's tricky. And I'm not sure that I have, you know, all the answers. I will say I learned that I think the messenger matters. Mm-hmm. I think in some cases, young women hearing the message maybe from, you know, an older man versus a woman of childbearing age might change how that messaging is received. So that was one thing that we learned kind of as a department. I think the other thing that we learned about communication during the Zika epidemic was really the importance of having a reliable and trusted source, like that we always needed to maintain our integrity, that we needed to admit when we didn't know something, because I think the public gets really nervous and maybe starts acting in ways that are out of line with our recommendations when they feel like they're not getting the whole story. So I think during Zika, because we didn't know very much in the beginning and we were learning in real time, that we felt it was very important to communicate exactly what we did and what we didn't know. And, you know, we can't answer this, but what we can tell you is, in, you know, what you can do based on the knowledge we have. Mm-hmm. And sometimes that's difficult to communicate because you feel like as a public health authority, you want to know everything and convince people that you're knowledgeable. But I think that they sort of relax and take the message in more when you're upfront.
Yeah, that is really important to be able to admit and just be honest with people. So basically you were the real life Kate Winslet in Contagion. Is that what you felt like? How do you feel about that portrayal?
That's so interesting that you say that because, I mean, Zika virus obviously is vector-borne disease, and we didn't have the vector. I didn't personally feel at risk in Portland, Oregon, but I was deployed when I was at CDC for Ebola, so I do know that kind of that fear of going to a place where the epidemiology of the pathogen isn't as well understood. I went in 2007. And so I think that the Kate Winslet portrayal, your question about that, interestingly, that came out after I had left CDC or right as I had left, but they did a screening for the EIS officers who they were trying to see if it was real, you know, how real it was. Yeah. And they did have a couple of zingers in there of lines that sort of matched, like, what is your single overriding communication message? Yeah. Like, that's what you're supposed to have in the field. Yes.
And so after all of that, you've ended up here at the University of Arizona as an assistant professor, and you are leading a research program focused on antimicrobial resistance and stewardship. And you've taught courses in infectious disease epidemiology, history of infectious diseases, and border health as well. So that's what we're here to talk about today, antimicrobial resistance. So if I could just have you explain what that is for those who might not know.
Sure. So antimicrobial resistance is what happens when pathogens like bacteria or fungi sort of develop or evolve the ability to circumvent or to get around the drugs that are designed to kill them. And so this is a problem because pathogens that are resistant to antimicrobials can cause infections that last for a long time, that result in extended hospital stays or additional doctor's visits, and importantly can have side effects for the individuals. They can have other infections like Clostridium difficile or C. diff, which is a major side effect from taking antimicrobials. And also sometimes the drugs that are used to treat these resistant infections are toxic and cost a lot more. So there are sort of implications across the board for this problem.
Yeah, and we've seen some of those toxic medications you're talking about, they haven't been used in years and years, and we were pulling them back off the shelf because those are the only ones that are working now.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, I think one of the reasons we should care about it maybe more than we have in the past is that the pipeline for new antimicrobials is drying up. And one of the reasons why we haven't been developing drugs at the same pace that the bugs have been becoming resistant to the drugs is that there's really the economic incentive in pharmaceutical development is really venture capitalism. Mm-hmm. And antimicrobials are different than other drugs out there on the market, like cholesterol drugs or some lifestyle drugs, in that the more that I use antimicrobials, the worse or the less effective they'll be for you, and vice versa. And this just isn't the case with other drugs. They'll be just as effective 30 years from now as they are now. And so it brings the issue back home. And what can we do as stewards of these antibiotics? And aside from kind of, you know, investing or encouraging political will to invest in new drug development, we can protect the drugs that we do have through these antimicrobial stewardship programs.
So I know you work a lot in skilled care nursing facilities, facilities. So when you are implementing or creating a stewardship program, what's the timeline look like? How do you go about doing that?
So it looks really different depending on what kind of setting you're in. So in healthcare, really a lot of antimicrobial stewardship programs. So just to step back and define stewardship, it's really using antibiotics when they're needed. So for a real infection that's treatable with antibiotics or antifungals, and then for the right time, for the right duration. So a recent report released by CDC looked at the appropriateness of antimicrobial prescribing in outpatient and emergency room settings. And so this is where actually most of the antibiotics in the U.S. are dispensed. And the study found that about 30% of those prescriptions, which is about 47 million prescriptions overall, over a one-year period were inappropriate. So that means that's a lot of antibiotics being prescribed for non-infections or for infections that are viral or not treatable with antibiotics. And so even with the remaining 70% too, we know that there's room for improvement in terms of like duration. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, we know most adults with community-acquired pneumonia should be treated for 5 days. But at this stage, many are treated for 10 days because that's the way it's been done in the past. And so when we think about stewardship in healthcare settings, if you look at kind of the literature of what works and where it's been developed, mostly it's been in really big academic medical centers with infectious disease experts and physicians. And that's great. And there's been some early successes with some of the programs they've been implementing about, you know, kind of looking at prescription data, reevaluating whether someone should be on an antibiotic, getting buy-in from leadership and education. And what where we are kind of now is trying to move outside of those big academic medical centers into more resource-limited settings, mm-hmm. like skilled nursing facilities where I work, which are kind of like nursing homes, mm-hmm. ambulatory surgical centers, physicians' offices, urgent care. So these are all settings where most of the nation's antimicrobials are prescribed mm-hmm. to humans outside of those big hospitals. And so trying to figure out what works in those settings where there might not be or there often aren't the infectious disease experts and where there's sort of more prescribing norms have really been entrenched and where patients expect it to. So.
And I know you have done some work with this, with stewardship programs along the border. What's mm-hmm. that experience been like?
Absolutely. So as you mentioned, sort of these infectious diseases don't see borders. Mm-hmm. And certainly that's the case in the U.S. and Mexico. And so my work on the border has really first been to define, you know, what are the levels of antimicrobial resistance on the border? And that's actually not as simple as it sounds. So we need to actually extract data from labs and mm-hmm. see, you know, out of all of, for a given pathogen, what are the levels of resistance to various drugs? And even just that kind of descriptive epidemiology can be helpful to providers because if they know that in their region with this specific bug, only 30% are susceptible to an antibiotic and 70% are resistant, they might look to prescribe something different. Mm-hmm. So that's how kind of providers can be helped. So we're looking to sort of explore what are the rates of resistance on both sides of the border. And then we're also trying to understand whether attitudes about antibiotic use have changed in the border region. Mm-hmm. We know that there have been several studies in both in Mexico and Latino populations around the U.S. Looking at sort of attitudes towards self-care with antibiotics.
Yes.
And Mexico is no different than many other countries in that many people, instead of going to a doctor's office, will go to a pharmacy. Mm-hmm. And antimicrobials have sort of traditionally been used to treat viral infections mm-hmm. and all kinds of things that do not require antibiotics. And this is, you know, one of the reasons we see emerging resistance in these settings.
Yeah. I think that's a great segue into just my asking this question of how do we promote proper use of antimicrobials or antibiotics in our own lives?
One thing you can do is just try to prevent infections in general. And by one really important action that everybody can take is to get vaccinated and to vaccinate your children, because if you have fewer of these viral infections, they won't be mistaken for bacterial infections mm-hmm. and be inappropriately treated. So that's a big one. Hand hygiene in general. So even if you are not overusing or misusing antimicrobials, those bugs are out there and they can be transmitted. So just basic hygiene practices, hand hygiene, food preparation. We know that there's a lot of antibiotics in agriculture, a lot of antibiotic pressure. And so kind of making sure that you practice safe food preparation, so not chopping your vegetables on the same cutting board as your chicken and things like that. And also communicating with your physicians. One of the things we've learned from sort of the sociological side or take on antimicrobial resistance and stewardship is that many physicians feel pressured both by the fear of the worst case scenario, that mm-hmm. someone's going to have an infection that will kill them if they don't treat it immediately, and also fear that their patients will not be satisfied. Mm-hmm. So we've actually learned that physicians and other prescribers actually anticipate more pressure from the public than actually exists, at least in certain U.S. settings. Yeah. And so one thing you can do or encourage people in your jurisdiction to do if you're a public health professional is to encourage people to speak with their physician to say, what can I do to prevent infections? How do you know this is the right antibiotic? How long do I need to be on it? Did you do what test did you use to mm-hmm. determine that this is the appropriate antibiotic? And that sort of opens the door and for the physician to have that conversation, which sometimes they report sort of trying to avoid because they feel like they'll get a lot of pressure. And just mm-hmm. to go back quickly to our border point too, I think that physicians in this region, anecdotally and some of the research we're doing and talking to providers in border facilities will say there's an added layer of pressure from families because we know that they can just go across the border and get antibiotics or they know someone who went across the border and has come back and can give that. So sometimes that argument that we expect this and if you don't give it to us, we're going to leave and get it elsewhere is more prominent.
That's really interesting. So we were discussing, we touched a little bit on how AMR, antimicrobial resistance, is also a One Health issue. And we did have Dr. Pragriba Brown on another episode.
Excellent.
She was also getting into it a little bit. But can you discuss the role that agriculture and aquaculture plays in contributing to AMR?
Absolutely. So we know that in the U.S., if you look at all antimicrobials dispensed in the U.S., about 80% go to agriculture and aquaculture. This is because for many years, and actually, if you look at antibiotics, they've only been used widely in medicine for about from 60 to 70 years, and in agriculture for less than 50. And so this is really sort of a recent phenomenon. And sort of early on in the factory farming industry, it was discovered that antibiotics served as growth promoters. We don't totally understand why, but we know somehow the disruption of the gut affects metabolism, and these animals would grow fat very quickly. And there was also sort of this idea that by keeping animals on antibiotics prophylactically, we could avoid sort of outbreaks mm-hmm. within in the big populations of animals on feedlots. And so this is actually, we've seen just emerging resistance in these animals.
And that's really important from the economic perspective of the farmer who wants to prevent outbreaks from happening and having all their animals be sick. So that's why it's kind of used prophylactically.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And that's why sort of the community approach is really important. If only one farmer is really practicing antimicrobial stewardship, they might be on the losing end mm-hmm. of sort of the economic spectrum. So that's why sort of all of these approaches, we need to really approach it from that community perspective. Mm-hmm. And some things have changed recently. So, for example, in 2017, the FDA passed the Veterinary Feed Directive, which basically stipulates that when medically important antibiotics, and by that I mean antibiotics that are medically important for humans, are used in agriculture, mm-hmm. that needs to be under the supervision of a licensed veterinarian. So that's new. So prior to 2017, tons of feeds that were used routinely for animals had antimicrobials, and now those are being reevaluated with the idea that this shouldn't be just something given in a low dose in food where mm-hmm. all that antimicrobial pressure, of course, contributes to resistance, and that these antibiotics should be used when animals need them for medical reasons.
And I'm not sure if you know the answer to this question. I didn't include it, but do you know anything about how the U.S. compares to other countries when it comes to antimicrobial stewardship programs and just talking about AMR from both the healthcare aspect and an agriculture aspect? What do our policies look like in the U.S. compared to other countries?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there's a spectrum, right? And mm-hmm. we're compared to some countries, we have more regulated, more regulations on antibiotic distribution. So in this country, you need a prescription. And mm-hmm. that's not true in many countries, even across the border in Mexico, where there's been some recent policy changes, you can still go into a pharmacy and there will be usually someone on site who could issue you a prescription quickly. Mm-hmm. So we, in some ways, it's harder to get antimicrobials here or there's more restrictions on their use. And by the way, we sort of have tried to change. You asked me about communication. We've tried to change how we communicate that. Instead of saying restricted antibiotic use, as I just did, we're trying to change that to protect. We're protecting these antimicrobials so that it feels less of telling people what they can't do and more just recommending something, a positive action they can take. But that said, there are countries in Europe that have far more information about the types and the amounts of antibiotics distributed in agriculture, for example. So although we've had some positive changes in terms of these, you know, new rulings by the FDA and raised awareness about antibiotics in agriculture, even some consumer pressure to try to get just the indiscriminate use of antimicrobials out of food, we still don't have a great sense of exactly, we don't have great surveillance about which types of antimicrobials are used and how much, where some European countries have really prioritized that.
Yeah.
And they've really been able to, we see lower rates of antibiotic-resistant infections in those countries.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Going back to the use of antibiotics in agriculture and the food we eat, how does that relate or translate to human health? Does that have an impact on us? And does that change kind of our gut and what's going on with us and make us more susceptible to getting in healthcare acquired infections?
Yeah, so these are all great questions that should be like sort of on the platform of research to come. You know, it's you're sort of setting a research agenda for the future. I mean, we really don't know the answer to a lot of those questions, but there's some highly suggestive research that some of the infections seen as healthcare, or people presenting to healthcare, for example, with highly resistant urinary tract infections, that some of those pathogens are identical to the pathogens found on retail meat. So how that human acquired that, was it from eating? Was it from a contaminated surface that they were exposed? We're not totally sure, but that is definitely an area of research which is very active right now, trying to understand the link between the antibiotic-resistant bacteria in our environment, which we know sort of in healthcare settings, there's sort of people have obvious portals of entry for infections. But if we think about all of the antibiotic-resistant bacteria that are in the guts of farm animals, and then when that contaminates the soil that, you know, or the waterways that irrigate the lettuce that you eat, you know, so this, I think, you know, vegetarians aren't safe from this by any means, because there's certainly transfer of those organisms from the feed animals to the vegetables.
Yeah,
and so we're really trying to understand, like, what the impact of that is. So.
Yeah, it's like a really complex issue that's, like I said earlier, multifaceted. Just there are so many different routes of entry, and it's mind-blowing to me, which is why it's so interesting to study.
It really is. So related to antibiotics in agriculture and consumer pressure, there's a lot of confusion about labeling of products, like being antibiotic free, and what does that mean. And I'll just note that there isn't great guidance on to industry about what that label should include. And so the best that you can assume is that at the point of slaughter, that animal did not have antibiotics in its system. That does not mean that they don't have pathogens in their system that are resistant to antibiotics. If that makes sense.
Yes.
So they may not be on antibiotics. They could be raised in an area where they have acquired that by another means. They've acquired a multi-drug resistant organism or something like that. So that's important to keep in mind. And so you'll see sort of a variety of labels raised without antibiotics. And so, you know, I think as consumers, it's important to be it's important to support, you know, industries that try, but also just be wary that these labels don't come with like sort of concrete criteria behind them. And there's so I think that that's on the docket, though. I think we'll start seeing more kind of accountability of industry for what they say they're doing.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I'm confused every time I go into the grocery store. I don't know which one to buy, and I end up like reading the labels and being confused. And I would go so far to say as I'm pretty educated on the topic, since I did take, you know, the One Health class, and I try to look at it, but it's still really confusing. So
it is. Yeah. And so I think that's a real opportunity for improvement, both with industry, but then also the agencies that regulate, like, you know, FDA and USDA, really becoming concrete about what that means, and also having some sort of teeth behind the recommendations. It's one thing to recommend something to industry. It's another to sort of hold them accountable.
for a lot of the issues that we've discussed on the podcast before, we've talked about health disparities mm-hmm. and how certain diseases or topics that we're talking about, for example, climate change, impact vulnerable people more than people with a higher SES, let's say. Is that the case with AMR? Is there any health disparity issues here? I'm just asking because mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think there are disparities on many fronts. I think I mentioned before that this sort of seeking of care through pharmacy, you know, through mm-hmm. through either antibiotics you get from a pharmacy or at a flea market. A lot of this happens because people have real barriers to care in a physician's office. So I think any disparities in access to care certainly translates into this sort of notion that, you know, you need to treat yourself.
Yeah.
And antibiotics are out there and they're around. And in some ways, getting antibiotics out to low and middle income countries, having them being produced in places like India and sold cheaply on the market is a huge success story mm-hmm. Because antibiotics save lives. And on the other hand, because in many of these countries there are fewer regulations, there's less education, and sometimes there's even more environmental contamination. And so I think that the problem of antibiotic resistance, it really is emerging faster in low and middle income countries. And we even see it, we name these resistance mechanisms after where they have been seen first. Mm-hmm. So if you think of like New Delhi metallo-beta-lactamase, the NDM, that was first identified in India, where we have a huge problem with antibiotic overuse and antibiotic resistance.
You mentioned how antibiotics are a huge success story in modern medicine. What would happen if we were to return to an era of pre-antibiotic medicine? What would that look like for us?
Yeah, that's sort of the fear that this post-antibiotic era will look a lot like the pre-antibiotic era. Yeah. And when you know, a minor cut could get infected, and if you became septic, you would die. And and importantly, we've made so many medical advances since the discovery of antibiotics, which were discovered in 1928 and broadly available by the 40s. And those things include chemotherapy, transplant medicine, a lot of really invasive medical procedures that suppress the immune system. And we wouldn't do any of those if we didn't have antibiotics at our disposal to treat the infections that patients will inevitably get if they have a suppressed immune system.
Yeah, it's crazy to think about. It's terrifying. It's really scary. Yeah. This episode, doing the research for this episode and the climate change episode both, just had me like terrified.
Up at night, right?
Yeah, up at night. So are there any people that are at especially high risk for developing healthcare acquired infections?
Absolutely. Yes, certainly the very young. So neonates mm-hmm. are at high risk because they're still developing their immune system. And part of what they need to do is get exposed to their environment and build their immunity. But when you have, you know, highly resistant, highly pathogenic bugs in the environment, those can be highly problematic for neonates. So mm-hmm. kind of at the poles of life. Then also people who are towards the end of life, they are also at higher risk for antimicrobial resistant infections. But I did want to say that these anyone at any phase of life is susceptible to these infections. People with chronic conditions are as well. So sort of another public health message that you could promote is managing chronic, when you're talking about managing chronic diseases like diabetes, that management will actually help your immune system and make you less likely to get these kinds of infections.
So, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Learned something new.
Yeah. I would just say also when we talked a bit about antibiotic stewardship in healthcare, mm-hmm. and we talked about all the pressures that that prescribers, so physicians or nurse practitioners, feel, and that, you know, it might be pressure from families, or it might be just the fear of the worst case scenario, the fear of getting sued. We have a very litigious healthcare system, and yes. medical malpractice is a huge fear. And so people, there's sort of been an enculturation of prescribing just in case. And when you actually kind of try to pick apart the motivations, it makes a lot of sense. And so one of the things we try to do when implementing or designing stewardship programs or evaluating them is to try to understand how that prescriber can best be supported. Because one of the things we see, for example, in skilled nursing facilities is if a prescriber or physician is not on site all the time. So they may just get a call from someone at the facility, hey, we think so-and-so has an infection, can you prescribe? And if that's all the information you had, then it might make sense to prescribe. Yeah. And so what we try to do is develop, a very kind of a standardized way of reporting symptoms, mm-hmm. of indicating to the provider that if we put this person on observation for 48 hours, they will be monitored closely. So trying to kind of get at what's the root cause of the motivation to prescribe and to try to support providers rather than vilifying them. You know, they're not the cause of the problem. And so any solution has to kind of incorporate their confidence in what they're doing for their patients.
Yeah, I love that. I think there are a lot of problems in public health we should approach from that perspective rather than vilifying people and kind of attacking people. And like you said, when you were talking about being an EIS officer, trying to communicate with people in a way where you're not telling them that you know the best, but trying to work with them more.
Right, exactly. Yeah. And trying to understand where they're coming from. And yeah, I think that.
Yeah. Are there any myths? I think I already asked you this maybe. Are there any myths surrounding antimicrobial resistance that you want to dispel? I know there's a lot of false information out there around this topic.
Right, around any topic.
Yeah, but, around all topics.
I would say one common myth is that people or bodies become resistant to antibiotics, and that's not the case. It's that the bacteria or fungi in our environment or living in or on our bodies can become resistant to the drugs designed to kill them. Mm-hmm. And that is important. I think it's also important that we just recognize that many of these bacteria, for example, have been around for 3.5 billion years.
Yeah.
Humans have only been around for 200,000, and use of antibiotics in modern medicine has been around for fewer than 75 years. So the bacteria have been competing for scarce resources for billions of years. They've evolved many mechanisms to survive. And so that's what we're seeing now. Once we put specific antibiotic pressure on them or antimicrobial pressure, then they sort of have all of these different resistance mechanisms at their disposal.
Yeah, they have the tools they need to survive.
They've been honing them over billions
over
of years.
So we're late to the game here.
Yeah.
And I know this is a podcast, so it's not very visual, but if you are interested, if the audience is interested, there's like a really cool chart that shows the scale of like how long bacteria have been around and how long humans have been around. I think they use like a football field for scale, but it's really mind-blowing to see it in kind of a visual way. Well, Dr. Ellingson, thank you so much for coming to the training center today and just getting to chat with you. I love chatting with you, and I'm glad that our audience was able to hear about all the work that you've done in the past and the work that you're going to continue to do. So thank you so much for joining me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
If you are looking to obtain continuing education credits for listening to this podcast, please head to moodle.publichealth.arizona.edu and click on the Keeping Up with Public Health tab in the WR PHTC section and take the post-evaluation survey for this episode. This podcast is supported by the Western Region Public Health Training Center. You can find more of our work at www.wrphtc.arizona.edu. You can also find us on Twitter at WRPHTC. A special thank you to Eric Healy for editing and producing the show, in addition to creating the music for each episode.